You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 9th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
It was a healthy thing for the Democratic Party to have a contested primary. I thought that Bernie Sanders brought enormous energy and new ideas, and he pushed the party and challenged them. I thought it made Hillary a better candidate.
President Barack Obama meets with Senator Bernie Sanders, presumably to tell him his race is now run. But will Sanders listen, and should he? My guests Isabel Hilton and Samira Shaka will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including politics in the post-truth era, Peru's excruciatingly close presidential election, and the use of soap opera as a soft power weapon. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and Samira Shackle, freelance journalist specializing in social affairs, politics, race, and South Asia, among other things. Welcome both to the program, and we will start with the US presidential election. It is now effectively down to two candidates, despite what the third one still running appears to believe. Bernie Sanders was due at the White House today to meet President Barack Obama, who it is widely assumed will be presenting the irascible senator from Vermont with the proverbial revolver and shot glass on a silver platter, and suggesting he take a walk in the woods. Isabel, Sanders is supposed to be speaking at a rally at RFK Stadium later tonight, and so he's clearly lost none of his pulling power. That's quite an arena. Should he use his podium to throw in the towel?
It's a tricky one, isn't it? There are those who believe the longer he goes on, the more he will, when he finally does endorse Hillary, which I would hope he did, the more he'll be able to deliver his supporters to Hillary. If he pulls out now, there's a risk that it will be seen as the Democratic establishment crushing, you know, this great man.
Like a bug.
Like a bug. And you know, Donald Trump, after all, issued his warm invitation to Sanders supporters to join his campaign. So there is a danger that the kind of idea of insurgency is so strong now, and rebellion is so strong now in the Sanders following, that they could just go the wrong way. So I think he it's going to be tricky what he says tonight, but I think he has somehow to get his supporters to accept that whatever the final result of, you know, at the convention, if it were to go to a convention, they have to back Hillary. It's very delicate.
Samira, he has unveiled a new slogan, "The Struggle Continues." but to what end? I mean, is he just basically hoping that if he stays in this, then maybe the email thing or some other Clinton scandal will scupper Hillary, at which point it's his by default? Or does he have another agenda?
Yeah, it's difficult to say. I mean, I don't think that, barring some hugely surprising event, it seems pretty unlikely he's going to get the nomination. But I don't know. I think that, you know, he is someone who's been consistently quite committed to his ideals. It's possible he doesn't want to lose the platform for those sort of progressive arguments and sort of wants to keep them going, doesn't want to be sidelined by, as we've been saying, the sort of Democratic establishment taking over the much more centrist policies of Hillary Clinton suddenly being all that's getting attention. And he's old and he doesn't really care about a position in the party afterwards. He's not sort of seeking to sort of become Secretary of State or to stay in with the establishment. He's never really been in with the Democratic Party establishment for his entire career. So he just doesn't have those.
He hasn't even been a member of the Democratic Party.
Exactly, yeah. So he doesn't have any of those sorts of things which often make people more willing to toe the line. And I think there is a genuine sense with Sanders and amongst his campaign that this is a sort of unique moment for progressive politics in the US. It's a unique sort of spotlight on the sort of socialist progressive politics, and that maybe they're not quite ready to let that go.
On that thought, though, Isabel, I just wonder if I'm sure the conversation has been had in Camp Clinton, but at some point she has to make a decision about whether she is more likely to win votes from independents or moderate Trump not liking Republicans, or whether she's best off shoring up the entire Democratic base. And if she picks the latter option, is Vice President Sanders really such a terrible idea?
I'm not sure that Vice President Sanders would go for it, actually.
Bookies don't think so. 10-1 behind Elizabeth Warren, Julian Castro and Tim Kaine.
Yeah, it's... I mean, the Elizabeth Warren option is kind of interesting.
We will come to that.
But I think the problem with Sanders is that he's been fighting Hillary all this time on this tremendous wave of support, got far further than anyone ever imagined. And he kind of doesn't. He's like the character that's gone off the cliff and the legs are still going round. You know, you can see this. He doesn't know how to stop. And somebody has to somehow take him by the hand and pay fulsome tribute, make all his supporters feel they're completely wonderful, and lead him gently into an armchair. Because I really don't think that as Hillary's running mate, he could stop bashing Hillary.
I mean, it must be, in fairness to him, a genuinely hard thing to walk away from. At the end of a career, especially at the end of a career spent largely in obscurity, although to the extent that a US senator is an obscure character, but you get to be not a centre of not just national, but of extraordinary global attention. And then all of a sudden someone's telling you, mate, sorry, you're done.
You're the guy who didn't make it.
Yeah, it would be... Yeah, it'd be like a sportsman being told he was too old and that his time had come. But it'd be a tough one to walk away from.
Well, it's tough at a personal level, but it's also tough because it's a crusade after all. And you know, the problem is, where does the crusade go? And that's the delicate thing for everybody. If he was just a conventional rival in the sense that they usually are, you know, the kind of interchangeable figures who fight it out in primaries, it would be different. But this is a crusade and it has to be directed somewhere.
We should talk about that Elizabeth Warren possibility, which has been suggested. The bookmakers have her firmly in the running with Julian Castro and Tim Kaine. Samira, is there, leaving aside the qualifications or otherwise of Hillary Clinton and or Elizabeth Warren to do those roles, and I'm sure they're both perfectly capable of doing them, is there a reason, well, it would be nice to think the answer's no, but are we still living in a world in which putting two women on a presidential ticket would be potentially electorally risky?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's huge misogyny in politics. We've seen it, I think, quite consistently. Obviously, there's the basic fact that Hillary Clinton, when Sanders sort of agrees that she's the candidate, is the only woman to be in the presidential race. In the UK, we've only had one woman political leader, head of state, I mean. And so I think that it is undoubtedly a reality that two women on a presidential ticket is a risk. And I think that's something reportedly that Elizabeth Warren's quite acutely aware of, sort of with the broader aim in mind of wanting to defeat Trump. And it would be nice if we didn't live in a world like that. But sadly, you just have to have a glance at the tone of political coverage and discourse, you know, sort of a woman who is ambitious, and the way you hear people talk about Clinton is consistently sort of cold, unfeeling, ambitious, pushy, all of those things. I think that is just that sort of language, or alternately just seen as weak and irrational. So I think that kind of gendered perception of public figures in general and politicians in particular does mean it would be a challenge.
Is there another, Isabel, potential risk with Elizabeth Warren in that a not insignificant number of people, and I would if I was American, frankly, count myself among them, might rather wish that Elizabeth Warren was at the top of the ticket rather than the vice presidential nominee?
No question. And there was clearly an effort to get her to run. You know, there were very long and interesting profiles suddenly appeared when there was a possibility that she might run. And she is, you know, she would have spoken very powerfully to the Bernie Sanders constituency in that she has been a scourge of Wall Street and the bankers and the kind of backers that Hillary can't detach herself from. So Hillary can't walk away from Wall Street and probably wouldn't want to. But she has been, you know, really robust and made her name kind of trying to sort out the post-financial crisis mess. She's younger. She's attractive. She's definitely more radical than Hillary. And she's not also tarnished with all that
baggage. Indeed, large numbers of Americans, rightly or wrongly, don't hate her, which is clearly a factor with Clinton.
Indeed it would. But I think that is one reason why perhaps she won't be on the ballot, apart from the fact that two women would be seen as a kind of monstrous regiment.
you can imagine Trump's election attack videos.
Yeah, I can imagine. Yeah.
He might just be so bewildered that he doesn't he doesn't really know where to start. Yeah.
But the thing that she might do is help to deliver Bernie's constituency to Hillary, because she's definitely backing. She is definitely a kind of Trump has to be stopped character and would be backing.
And that's one of her, the sort of the things, apart from the fact, as you say, a lot of people don't hate her and a lot of people are very enthusiastic about her, is the fact that she is someone who, with her support, she could potentially unify the Democratic Party and the sort of the huge section of people who would naturally vote Democrat, who are now sort of alleging a sort of conspiracy to oust Sanders, might be brought on board by Warren's fulsome support, whether as a running mate or not.
Okay, well, let's move along to a not unrelated subject, because it is hard to know precisely what can be expected from a presidential campaign in which one of the candidates is Donald Trump. It is easier to be sure of what cannot be expected, which is an earnest, thoughtful and constructive discussion of the issues punctiliously rooted in verifiable truth. Here in the United Kingdom, we are presently engaged with our own experiment with post-fact politics, and that is the referendum on EU membership, which began what feels like centuries ago now as a fatuous, inflammatory and often unhinged cacophony of rabble-rousing tantrums, and has proceeded steadily downhill. Samira, have people actually stopped caring about the facts, or does it just feel like that if you spend too much time reading the internet and social media?
Yeah, it's hard to say, really, because I think if you're on the flip side of that, if you are paying close attention to the internet and social media, you're getting the fact-checking of the inaccuracies. And I just wonder how much of that conversation is filtering through to the general public who aren't sitting on social media and sort of reading takedowns of certain claims and whether they're true or not, and whether it's just the sort of inaccurate statistics that get through. I think that if we're thinking about perceptions of the EU referendum campaign, it's got the sort of unfortunate combination of being incredibly important and incredibly boring, and I don't know how much it's really
and incredibly
through.
Emotive, which is even worse.
Yeah, exactly. And so I think sadly there's probably quite a receptive audience to, you know, when Nigel Farage says that 5,000 ISIS jihadis have been allowed into the EU, which he's been corrected on by Europol. But I'm sure there are people who will hear that and not be interested in the fact that Europol have completely refuted the stat.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, this is I think Jonathan Swift made the joke first and Mark Twain made a variation on it and so on and so on and so on, that the truth can be halfway around the world. The lie can be halfway around the world before the truth gets its boots laced. Isabel, is that the problem, especially now in a kind of always on hyperactive 24-hour media that, I mean, and Samira mentioned, you know, this absurd claim that Nigel Farage keeps making that, you know, the EU has waved 5,000 ISIS jihadis into Britain. It isn't true. Europol says it's not true. The Leave campaign also saying that the EU costs Britain 350 million quid a week, which it doesn't, and raising scare stories about Turkey joining the EU, despite the fact that Turkey will put a manned mission on Jupiter before it joins the EU. But it doesn't matter.
And then the entire population would move here, of course.
Well, of course. What of Jupiter?
possibly worried about migration, but certainly of Turkey first.
If we start talking about this loudly enough that Jupiter is going to join the EU, in fact, I think if I put that on Twitter now, by this time tomorrow, it would be, you know, Jupiterians, if
indeed
that's the word, coming over here. And I don't know what they do. I don't know what they do on Jupiter. I don't know what expertise they would bring us.
I don't know, but they'd take our jobs when they came, wouldn't they?
Well, if they get all the way here from Jupiter, they're cleverer than we are. I fear we may be drifting from the topic somewhat, but is the trouble that when you refute these claims, that it just keeps the claim alive, and people who are determined to believe that anyway, they're not going to change their minds, are they?
I think the disturbing thing that I've noticed in post-fact politics is that the more ready you are to lie, you know, the more, in a way, the more progress you make, because people, you can refute these claims, but a number of people just then say, I can't believe anybody. One says one thing, one says the other. And then they kind of vote with their emotions, and the Brexit crowd are kind of, you know, playing on fear all the time and playing on completely unfounded fears. So all the migration fears are in a way unfounded. You know, migrants contribute more to the economy than they take out. You know, all the things that are attributed to the arrival of migrants are really down to British policy, which wouldn't change. And in any event, the Brexit campaign has been very unclear whether we leave the single market, in which case we would have a economic crisis, or we stay in the single market, in which case we still have EU migrants, who are only half of the incoming migrants. So, but all of that, you can see people kind of, you know, sticking their fingers in their ears and just rolling their eyes and saying, I don't know what to believe. And that's the problem, that the public loses the will to understand what the truth is rather than you know, just believing Nigel Farage.
I mean, there's always been a tendency for people just to believe what they want to believe and assemble the facts
around the belief.
Around them. But the thing is now, Samira, you don't have to engage with the agreed narrative if you don't want to. I mean, 25, 30 years ago, if you wanted to believe that the Earth was flat or that, you know, people from Jupiter, if indeed they are people on Jupiter, were going to come here and take all our jobs, you could believe that, but you would keep running up and against an agreed narrative which kept telling you, no, that isn't happening and you're insane. Whereas now you can avoid that because you can exist entirely in a media carapace telling you that people from Jupiter are coming here to take all your jobs.
Yeah, absolutely. You can find your own echo chamber, whatever you want it to echo back to, I think, if that's the sort of downside, I think, of the internet age, is the fact that people aren't, you're not sort of consuming the narrative that's given to you, as you say, which is a positive in some senses, but it is also a negative if it's sort of you're choosing to be in a world that just sort of reinforces the prejudices that you already have. And I think coupled with what Isabel was saying, the fact that we live in an age where, with good reason probably, the trust in politics and in politicians is at an all-time low. I think there's so much cynicism about politics in this country, certainly, that there is a... there's not that much of an interest really in what's true or not. And you kind of, if you think rationally, you'd expect it to damage someone's credibility quite considerably if a politician is making a claim which is just fundamentally factually incorrect. And yet it doesn't really seem to have any noticeable impact on polls or on public standing or on the political process whatsoever when outright lies, not just inaccuracies, but outright lies are outed. And so I think that really speaks to not just the fact that people can seek out whatever echo chambers they want to, but also the fact that people are quite disengaged, I think, from the political process across the board and with politicians particularly.
They think they're all lying glasses anyway, so why should you believe one over the other?
Yeah.
And there's also, Isabel, an incredibly... it seems to be getting more prevalent, at least, sort of gravitation towards beliefs in hidden hands and conspiracies. I mean, we've seen in the last 24 hours here the absurd situation in which a British MP, Sarah Wollaston, has switched sides. She was campaigning for Leave. She is now campaigning for Remain. Her stated reason for this was that she got, frankly, weary of the Leave campaign saying things that were just, you know, completely not true. Which is, of course, we should be clear that it's not like the Remain side have been entirely unaverse to spreading scare stories and telling stretches themselves. But already, in fact, within minutes of her saying it, the social media gets overrun by leavers claiming that she's a plant, that this whole thing was a pre-planned stunt, you know, going back months, and she's picked her moment to discredit the movement.
Well, I have to say the only real renewable resource in the world is human stupidity, which does seem to kind of come back at us with ever stronger waves, it's like when the Leave campaign were confronted with some of their lies in solid academic work from hither and yon, they attributed it all to the fact that the people who'd done that research had been funded by the EU, you know, years before in some cases.
It's the well, that's what you would say syndrome,
yeah,
isn't
absolutely.
It?
You know, it's there just
one,
wearying.
One thing I saw as well, someone on Twitter saying, I think the FT had said something pro-EU and saying, well, they make X amount of money from the EU, which is just from, you know, politicians subscribing to it. God forbid the British newspaper read by policymakers.
Yeah, well, there's only two more weeks to go and then we never have to think about this again, except that obviously we'll, because let's face it, Remain's going to win by about 2%, which is just going to make the argument even more entrenched and virulent. But on that happy thought, we will take a short break. You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller, along with Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle. Coming up next, the Peruvian presidential election. Seriously.
Evening. The Monocle Cafe is giving the age-old happy hour a special twist. Sit down for freshly made nibbles and refreshing drinks to take the edge off your day. Kick back, relax, and let us serve you from a great selection, whether your tipple is a crisp Forscht beer or a smooth Aperol spritz. We're putting the happy back into happy hour. Join us at the Monocle Cafe in London's Chiltern Street every day from 1730 to 1900 and until 2000 on Thursday, Friday and Saturday. Cheers.
Welcome back to Midori House with me, Andrew Miller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and Samira Shackle. Now, Peruvians who resolve to stay up to watch the results of their presidential election will now be at the end of their reserves and coffee and sanity. 4 days after polls close, the count goes on, a tiny margin separating the contenders, former World Bank economist Pedro Pablo Kuczynski and Keiko Fujimori, daughter of former president and current prisoner Alberto Fujimori. Adding to the delay has been the wait for postal votes to be flown in from overseas and domestic ballots from rural regions to be shipped down the Amazon. Isabel, this was supposed to be a stroll in the park for Keiko Fujimori.
Didn't turn out that way, did it?
What happened?
Well, she has lost before, but it's a very odd pattern because her party dominates Congress. So her party has, you know, more than 70 seats in Congress. Kuczynski's party has, you know, fewer than 20. So it is bizarre that when it comes to the personal vote, she doesn't carry it. She won't carry it. I think the remaining votes to be counted, she'd have to win, you know, 80% of them, and there's no particular reason why she should. So she doesn't carry it, and I suspect that the question of her father still weighs. So her father had an appeal to lower class Peruvians, particularly in the rural areas, because he seemed like a kind of humble Trollo figure. But actually, he then almost destroyed the constitution, got mixed up with disappearance, organized crime, and is serving 25 years, as you say. So the
name—it's actually
is
quite
not 25 years in front. I mean, the name is not really magic.
No, I was going to say I'm actually quite impressed she's done this well. You would think that name and that parentage would be something of a burden,
but bizarrely, she has managed to build a solid party in a country where parties tend to spring into being with a presidential candidate and disappear when the candidate, you know, when the president steps down. So, and it's a pattern in South American politics that one thing that's lacking in many of these democracies are, you know, parties that outlast the leader. So bizarrely, she's managed to build a party which, as I say, has a solid footing in Congress but can't quite make it herself.
Samira, it seems like not very long ago that people were getting terribly excited about this pink tie of left-wing populism sweeping South America. Mm. And yet we now have Peru basically making a choice between two centre-right free marketeers. Is this a specifically Peruvian thing, or possibly a suggestion that, you know, in between Brazil, Venezuela, Argentina, etc., the enthusiasm for the left-wing populism thing is beginning to dwindle a bit?
Yeah, it's hard to say, really. I mean, I think you do have lots of the leaders who were, I think, hugely popular at some point, sort of their legacies starting to dwindle, or perhaps the level of disillusionment. I don't know I think it would probably be premature to say that the allure of left-wing populism is altogether gone from the continent, because I think there's quite specific factors at play in this election, it seems, you know, as you know, sort of the very peculiar thing about the dynasty that she comes from, and that sort of fighting off that legacy of her father. So I think it's quite difficult to separate from the specifics and just quite how tightly fought it is. But I think that it's a very restive time across the continent.
It's also true that those left-wing populists didn't end terribly well.
Yeah.
You know, you've got Venezuela teetering on the brink of bankruptcy. You had Cristina in Argentina who had to be carried out, you know, barking from the Casa Rosada. It's not great. Yeah. And you've got the, you know, the PT in Brazil, Lula's party, mired in scandal, and his successor being removed by equally scandalous figures. So it's not, you know, it's not a great record to build on.
Okay, well, finally tonight.
أنا أطلب بكل محبة واحترام كبسة رز بلحم.
لو أنت تسكن في المريخ أنا بي وبسكن معك.
لك وشهودك كلهم أموات.
لازم السر هذا يكون بيني وبينك ولا مخلوق يعرف عنه.
That is a clip from The Big House, which is a new soap opera set in the Turkish province of Antalya, a popular holiday destination, though less so now than it once was between the war in neighbouring Syria and terrorist bombings in Ankara, Istanbul and other locations. Turkey's immensely valuable tourism industry has taken a substantial hit. Backers of The Big House hope that it may help. It's a Turkey-Saudi Arabian co-production, and its creators hope it will encourage Saudis to visit Turkey. Isabel, the soap opera has soft power. Can it work?
Well, it's huge, and it's not very consistently mapped. But there are soap opera powers which, in their spheres of influence, have tremendous impact. So Mexico is one, South Korea is another, and indeed Turkey. This isn't the first soap opera that Turkey's produced. Turkey's been a soap opera soft power for nearly a decade,
and it's
particularly in the Middle East.
Well, it's soap operas dubbed into Arabic are quite popular.
Well, that's
outside
right.
Turkey.
And one of the explanations is that Turkey represents, in rather kind of knotted up cultures in the Middle East, represents a notion of modern Islam, of an Islamic country that can be modern, that can be quite sexy, that the storylines are quite quite open. Whereas in Saudi Arabia, it's hard to imagine those being produced. So it does offer, it has tremendous cachet, actually.
I mean, researching this earlier, I did happen across what my own homeland refers to as the neighbours effect. This idea that the doings of suburban Ramsay Street have enticed thousands, millions of other people to visit Australia. Samira, has it ever enticed you to visit Melbourne, Neighbours?
No, I've got to say it hasn't. Not made it there, but I wasn't a huge Neighbours fan, so I think. But yeah, I sort of wonder with this.
It's having a bit of a renaissance at the moment. The whole hotel bombing fire storyline has on for weeks now. It's become like The Wire or something.
I mean, I can't say that.
I'm not sure The Wire did much for Baltimore.
No, I was just going to say, I'm not sure.
But actually, there were gangster tours of New Jersey, if you wanted to do those.
There were The Wire tours of Baltimore as well.
Oh, were there? Yeah, I mean, there's lots of tours like that, aren't there? I don't imagine EastEnders has done much for London, but...
But I think if you weren't going to Australia to do the Neighbours Trail, it's a slightly different proposition because you're not really likely to get blown up. Turkey's got a bit of a mountain to climb here.
It has. I also just wonder, as Isabel said, it's been a soap soft power for a decade, and I think not just in the Middle East, also I go frequently to Pakistan and people are obsessed with Turkish soap operas, I think, for quite similar reasons. There's the sort of historical ones, and The Magnificent Century was a very popular one about the Ottoman Empire, ran for many series. And I just sort of wonder if what a new soap opera will do differently to make it to sort of draw in lots of tourists if it hasn't already happened.
They're apparently going full-blown, upscale, six-star luxury. I don't think it's going to be a sort of restrained, minimal,
I suppose not,
subtle production.
Yeah, I just suppose, I sort of think that if it's going to make you want to visit somewhere, it has to be good as well. It can't just be a sort of extended tourist advert, because I think viewers are not stupid. So,
has it had that effect in Pakistan? Has it worked for Turkey in terms of as a tourist destination for Pakistanis?
I mean, hard to say. I mean, I think people certainly do go to Turkey. It's hard to say how related it is and how far that's to do with the fact that it's a sort of Muslim nation that people feel some affinity to, that's also quite an easy place to be and has all sorts of elements of Western culture. So it's hard to know what's what. Perhaps it does raise awareness. I think, as when I was reading about this earlier, that apparently it happens within the UK as well, sort of domestic tourism, when programmes like Broadchurch show or various other things that sort of spikes tourism to Dorset, even though that's a horrible murder-centred programme. It's just people like seeing the landscapes, I guess.
But Isabel, is there genuine potency? Because I can remember travelling in Eastern Europe in 1990, just after the revolutions, and all those huge padded-shoulder American soaps from the 80s, Dynasty and Dallas, were enormously popular.
Did it do anything for tourism? Did Dynasty do anything for tourism? I mean, they're certainly popular, and they create a kind of fantasy land that maybe people want to visit. But I'd have to be convinced about the numbers, honestly. I mean, I do think what they do is, I mean, certainly in the case of South Korea, it's created a profile for a country that, didn't have a lot else going for it except for electronic goods. I don't think that the culture of South Korea was particularly well appreciated until the soap operas really... And it was a conscious effort on the part of the government in popular music and in soap opera.
We will have to leave it there, unfortunately, and I, for one, believe that Paul Robinson is innocent. That's all we have time for on today's Midori House. It was produced by Marco Sippi, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Faith Barker. Our studio manager was Chris Chauvers. There's more music next. 1900, Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and I'll be back with the Monocle Daily with more on the day's main stories at 2200. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. As always, for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.